This is Bloomberg Intelligence.
Uber wants to beat Amazon of retail, of e-commerce.
The Disney Plus service might actually end up benefiting Netflix.
In-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
Capital return is the key story for the U.S. banks.
The telcos naturally are moving into content distribution. I think it's a good move.
Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Over the next hour, we are going to dig inside the big business stories impacting Wall Street and the global markets.
Each and every week, we provide in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies and 130 industries our analysts cover worldwide.
And today, we're going to look at the lines between big oil and utilities getting very blurry.
Plus, pipeline cancel culture, cost confrontation, and delays continue.
All right, but first, it's time to look at the U.S. presidential election. What, we're like 6 weeks away, 4 weeks, something like that. Our first guest writes that a Biden win could mean Facebook and Google get new federal controls. Joining us now with the story is Bloomberg Intelligence litigation analyst Matthew Schettenhelm. Hey, Matt, when I think about a Biden win, my first thought isn't like Google and Facebook and federal controls. I'm thinking about healthcare. I'm thinking about energy. Walk me through what you're thinking.
Yeah, I think that's right, Alex, and that's been a really positive development for the internet companies after a couple years of really intense scrutiny of their businesses. I think there's been a shift in attention away from them, and they're certainly fine with that. But I do think that if Democrats sweep to power in this election and both control Congress and take the presidency, the prospects of finally finishing the work that's been going on for the past couple of years in Washington, I think, improves significantly. And so while we've been sort of stalled in sort of this fight over, okay, how do we regulate these companies? I think it's pretty, you know, that the chances significantly go up that Congress can get something done that actually goes after these companies in 2021.
All right. So, Matt, you know, I know this was a concern for tech investors because the regulatory oversight of tech is generally in the U.S. really a light touch here, but there was some concern before the pandemic that that might change, privacy issues, data security issues, all those things, hauling these CEOs in front of Congress. Is there much appetite in Washington for that, or is it simply a fact that Washington's got other things on its mind right now?
Yeah, the remarkable thing about this, Paul, is how fast this has changed here in Washington. The idea, I mean, we went for decades, exactly what you said, that the internet works best with the regulators and the legislators out of the way. And what you've seen in just the past two to three years is almost a total reversal on that. And it's not just the Democrats who typically favor regulation. The Republicans, too, are pushing bills to do this. And even the industry itself is pushing legislation to avoid more problematic forms of legislation. So there's almost a total reversal on this. And so there's suddenly, you know, a real potential serious regulation of these companies instead of the approach of let's just stay out of the way, no federal limits whatsoever, very little state limits. We could see serious limits on how these companies collect data, how they share data, and how they operate, and strict enforcement to go along with that.
All right, so give me some concrete examples of, okay, we get a Biden win, what's going to be the first thing on the docket for tech?
Yeah, so what we're talking about here is really data privacy legislation that has the potential to make it through both the House and the Senate and be signed by President Biden. And you're talking about a couple pieces to it. One, transparency. The companies need to tell you more about what they're doing with your data. Fine. That's not that problematic. It just raises their costs. More problematic to the company is strict limits on what data they can collect from you and how they can use it. What a lot of people don't realize is every time they're clicking on something on the internet, they're giving Facebook and Google data. They're effectively paying for their services by doing that. And what you could see is lawmakers going after that business model and saying, look, this is too much control. We're giving away too much data, and we want to reverse that. Right now, the default rule is the companies can take all this data as much as they want and use it unless you, the user, go through and click to turn it off in the settings. And most people don't do that. What you could see at the extreme end of this is lawmakers saying, no, we're going to reverse the default rule. And Facebook and Google can't use your data unless the company, the people, the consumers, click through and turn it on. And most people aren't going to do that. And so that could really change how this business model operates. That's an extreme case, but I think for at least some forms of data, sensitive data, information about your health and your location, you're going to see that sort of provision put in place. At the extreme case, it would be put in across the board, and you can't use any data whatsoever unless people give you permission to do it.
So it's interesting, Matt. In Europe, they have done something like that, haven't they?
Yeah, so that's right. So this is building on the GDPR effort in Europe, and it's sort of trying to improve upon what's gone on there, because a lot of the pushback from GDPR is like, this just makes it, you know, easier for the incumbents to protect their dominance.
What does GDPR stand for, and kind of what is it doing?
Yeah, so it's General Data Protection Requirement Act.
And Paul. Come on, man. Yeah. GDPR. Get with what the cool kids are saying.
That's right.
Everybody's talking about it. But it's exactly along these same lines. It's sort of limiting how these companies can use your data without getting your permission to do it. Now, what's really slowed things down there in Europe is there are really strong debates about what the law means.
All right, thanks so much to Bloomberg Intelligence litigation analyst Matt Schettenhelm.
Coming up on the program, why London offices want a renaissance to avoid a ghost town fate.
And you are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 13 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
Our next guest points out that London's high-rise offices and financial services make it the most vulnerable to remote working and vacancy. Joining us to break it all down is Bloomberg Intelligence senior industry analyst Susan Munden. Susan, thanks so much for joining us, and what a timely topic here with UK going back into a partial lockdown here. Give us a sense of what it means for all the real estate in and around London.
The City of London, I think, is particularly vulnerable, and that's the square mile that we all talk about, is the financial services centre. And the reason I think it's most vulnerable is because it really is just offices. And so, I've been in and out the last couple of weeks, along with a few other colleagues, and it really is very quiet indeed.
Well, and I guess the problem is, is the problem that the offices can't actually have the right security to get people in, or is the problem lack of clarity from the government? How do we think about it?
I think it's a mixture of people still being concerned. No one went back until the schools went back. Well, very few people went until the schools went back. But in terms of security, I think for high-rise, yes, it is very difficult. There are two things there. One is you're going to have to queue quite a long time to get up to your floor. And the second thing is a lot of those people are traders. And, of course, they can't be waiting in the queue if the market suddenly opens. So they wouldn't want to risk that. And I think that will mean it's much more difficult to get some of those workers back to the city until we have the right, or we don't need to worry about social distancing so much.
Guys, so a side note here, it can take me like 25 minutes to get a cup of coffee. That's insane. Go ahead.
Yes, it is. It is. I experienced that. So, Susan, when I come over to London and to the beautiful Bloomberg offices there in the city, I am, over the last 10 years, I've seen nothing but cranes and construction. I cannot believe the boom in construction that I've seen in the city of London over the last decade. Where are we in terms of vacancies and rents and things like that? It just appears like a really bad supply and demand situation.
Brexit cut quite a lot of the development. There are a lot of cranes there. A lot of it is sort of on the borders of the city and more residential. As we went into the crisis, 45% of what was going up in London as offices was already let. And that's because the tenants wanted the new space, the green buildings, the good locations that, those buildings were in.
What happens then? What are we talking about in like 6 months?
So now, well, a lot of those buildings, they've been delayed for a start. Mm. So we've got 2 to 3 months because of the lockdown, and now the social distancing protocols mean it's just slower. Secondly, anyone who is going to go on site is rethinking what they're doing, and they're probably rethinking around doing more mixed use. And this is really what I think is my vision for London going forward. That the reason of, or the City of London, the reason that it's in such a bad state is it's just offices, whereas around the city in Shoreditch or in the West End or in what we call Midtown, their rents there were higher anyway, but there were lots of other uses and lots more residential there, and it gives it a vitality all the time. But without people going to work, the city is really very quiet.
So what is in the City of London, what is the vacancy rate right now? And kind of how did that compare pre-COVID?
Well, we haven't had September data. June was about 5.7%. It had ticked up a little bit. But the thing is, the vacancy won't include the physical vacancy. Physical vacancy at the moment is probably well less than 30%, but the tenancy agreements are still in place, and that's what that vacancy 5.7% figure is measuring. But actually people going in, our offices, for example, again, under 20% of the employees were going in.
And I guess the question then becomes, you know, once we get out of this, it doesn't, in a realistic way, it seems like they'll just be partial vacancies, that maybe it'll be 20 to 30% occupied or 40% occupied. And I'm trying to work out, does it make office buildings in urban areas more attractive because you need to have everyone come to that one location to stagger them? Or are you going to have like satellite offices now?
There's a lot of talk about satellite offices, and that might happen. But what I think is that because that area of London has great infrastructure physically, obviously with all the hubs and the commuting, but also professionally, that it will still remain a big hub. I do think there'll be a lot of innovation around how we manage to make our working from home more efficient, and that maybe there will be more roles that we can do more efficiently at home, and maybe some kind of online networking hubs to improve all of that. But there will still be, I believe, and I think a lot of other people are saying, the need to collaborate and be in a hub like that. Whereas regionally, you know, people come to London from quite a long way away. And so if you had a regional hub sort of south of London, then all the people from north, you know, practically it won't work. Mm.
So, Susan, you know, one of the topics that we used to love to talk about on a daily basis is Brexit. It has kind of been sidetracked or put on the back burner over the last 6 months. Where are we as it relates to big employers in the city moving employees or planning to move employees out of London?
I'm not hearing very much of that anymore. We obviously have had 4 years of Brexit talk. I think that, you know, there will still be changes. But actually, in terms of employment in London, the financial services have been retreating as employers, and the new space has been taken up much more by tech. And because of that, again, it's another reason why the city might reinvent itself, because the tech employers are on the sort of borders of the city at the moment, and they might start moving in because the rent's cheaper. And because, you know, if it reinvents itself, it'll have more fun and mixed use that, you know, they like. And those employers have always had a certain amount of working from home, too.
That's interesting. I wouldn't have thought, you know, tech for that, for London at all. But so how do we wind up looking at the winners and losers of this? I really hate asking those questions, and I always feel like I do, but there's going to be ones that are going to be able to come out on top, some are not. And I'm assuming with some support from the government is going to help pick those.
Yeah, I mean, the REITs invest in the City of London. Obviously, they have London office exposure, but only 20 to 30% of that at the moment of the four biggest office REITs is in that particular district. It's more around the periphery. So it might be an opportunity for them over time.
Hey, Susan, thanks so much for joining us. We always appreciate getting your perspective on the London and UK real estate market. That's Bloomberg Intelligence senior industry analyst Susan Munden.
Man, I feel sorry for the commercial real estate market. All right, yeah. Well, coming up on the program, we're going to take a look at the top themes to capture the emerging part of emerging markets.
You're listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio. providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence via BI Go on the terminal. I'm Paul Sweeney.
And I'm Alex Steele. It is 25 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
We'll be here each and every week at this time, tapping into our Bloomberg Intelligence analysts covering some 2,000 companies and 130 industries worldwide.
Our next guest joins us to break down the top emerging market themes. For more, we're pleased to welcome Bloomberg Intelligence Chief Emerging Markets Equity Strategist Gaurav Patankar. Gaurav, it's great to get your perspective. Typically, when you talk to an asset allocator or a global equity strategist, they're like, yeah, it's all about the dollar. Dollar goes down, good for emerging markets. End of story. What do you think?
Well, that could be partly true. I think the story is much more nuanced than that. And overall, the emerging market index has been relatively flat over the last several years. In fact, emerging markets used to be a growth market for a long period of time, but more recently, you know, it shows many more value characteristics than growth. Having said that, we think that there's a more nuanced way to partake in the emerging markets opportunity. And so I would talk about five themes. One is digital consumption, which we really like. They're dominant exporters that a bunch of countries are really trying to support. Wellness is emerging as a very important theme within EM, followed by fintech. Emerging markets, for example, have 21% weight to financials versus 11% in developed markets, but there's a rapid move to fintech to reach the bottom of the pyramid, and I'll talk in more detail later. And the industrial renaissance, where we are seeing two sub-trends of deconglomeration and infrastructure build.
So, and when I think about emerging markets, you know, I feel like I need to have a fairly high level of confidence in an economic recovery. And as I look out at the economic data here in a pandemic world, boy, I don't see much of that. What are you hearing from your institutional investor clients about their interest in emerging markets on the equity side?
Often we have seen that, you know, it's during these times when the outlook looks really bleak is kind of when is the best time to get into emerging markets. Now, having said that, the data speaks for itself. I think we are at a point in time where most of the emerging market governments are looking at ways to prime the pump. Just kind of following on the example here, a weaker dollar helps. There are still a bunch of countries where the real interest rates are higher than where they're here, so they have a little more elbow room to be a little more aggressive in the monetary side and as well as on the fiscal side. So from that standpoint, I think there's room for economic recovery cycles to begin at various stages in different emerging markets. And not, there are 26 different markets, so they each are very, very different. So it'll be, you know, not very synchronized from that standpoint.
But from your point of view, I mean, it's monetary and fiscal. Like we talk about that sort of coming together in the developed market. Well, it already is happening right now in emerging markets. So to get that fiscal and monetary boost. So I was interested in mentioning fintech, because usually if we think about tech and fintech, we're thinking China, we're thinking the U.S. Where in emerging market is that really emerging as a top theme in some top picks?
Sure, that's a very important question. And let's address it by starting with the legacy financial services sector within emerging markets. There have been a lot of bad loans and challenges to the balance sheets of the legacy banks, most of which are state-owned banks within most of the emerging markets. Again, there are clearly some private players who have done better than state-owned banks, but it's mainly a bank-heavy, old legacy sector with a lot of bad loans. In addition to that, there is a whole cost issue. Given that they're state-owned, they're not the most efficient institutions. On the other side, the real opportunity within emerging markets is the urban poor and at the bottom of the food chain in rural areas. So they really need to go rural, and they need to go really to the bottom of the pyramid within the urban regions. And what that essentially means is that they have to have a low cost of transaction and go to a whole new set of customers. And that's where fintech is really coming into play. So there are some new upstarts, you know, players like the CLOs of the world, Stone in Brazil, you know, a lot of players like Ant Financial that are emerging in China. But also, there are some legacy banks that are pivoting from the legacy banking models, credit-heavy models, to more of the efficient, reaching the bottom of the pyramid fintech models. So we see a significant opportunity there, and so our basket for fintech is also pivoted between the legacy players as well as some of the new players.
So, Gaurav, in order for, you know, fintech to obviously get the scale it needs, there has to be adequate broadband in a market, and there has to be adequate penetration of, you know, smartphones in some of these markets. How are the logistics of kind of those two market drivers right now as you look at some of the emerging markets?
So again, these markets are all very different. So think about a market like China. They're at a very advanced stage where the tech ecosystem, the broadband ecosystem, the mobile penetration, the identity verification, the security systems, they're all at the cutting edge. So think about China as the cutting edge, and think of some of the poorer ASEAN countries or some of the African countries at the lower end of the spectrum, and everyone else is in between. But the evolution is pretty rapid. Think about India, for example. There's about more than a billion people that are completely authenticated and ready to transact at the flip of a switch. But then there are many more billion people that are within the EM space as a whole that are yet to kind of catch themselves on that train.
You're so awesome. Thank you so much for joining us. Really enjoyed it. Bloomberg Intelligence Chief Emerging Market Equity Strategist Gaurav Patankar.
Coming up on the program, Blurred Lines, Oil Majors versus Utilities, next.
You are listening to Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on some of the 2,000 companies in 130 industries. You can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 39 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.
This is Bloomberg Intelligence with Alex Steele and Paul Sweeney on Bloomberg Radio.
The lines between big oil and utilities are getting very, very blurry. I want to bring in Bloomberg Intelligence senior industry analyst Elchin Mammadov. Okay, what does it mean? If you're big oil, you produce oil and then you sell it. If you're a utility, you're probably in the U.S. a regulated utility that sells me power from Con Ed that I can turn my lights on. How are they going to be the same?
Basically, the big oil is getting a push from investors and ESG funds to clean up their act, literally. So they're trying to reduce their emission intensity. And one way of doing that is to reduce their carbon footprint by producing oil more efficiently. The other way to do it is by investing in renewables like wind and solar.
So
that's where they compete with the utilities.
So, Elchin, I mean, these are oil companies. They make fossil fuels. I mean, can they pivot enough to satisfy maybe some of these market demands? It seems like you're asking these companies to change literally their DNA.
Yeah, I mean, they're saying that they're still going to invest in oil and gas. They're going to invest less in heavy oil and more in easier to extract oil. So that way they're going to improve their emission intensity. But they have very, very aggressive renewable capacity targets. So Shell, for example, wants to become the biggest utility, the biggest power company. And again, we're talking about 2030, 2050 vision, but still, the companies, the oil majors, have already started investing pretty heavily in renewables, but also in battery storage and electric vehicle charging and energy supply businesses. So it's not just renewables. And again, that's all the areas where utilities are investing.
So there's two scenarios on a bull bear case that I've read a lot about. And on the one hand, you say, look, these are very big companies that have a lot of different areas of expertise where it's going to be much easier for them to sort of shoehorn a utility model into their existing integrated model. And there's probably a lot of efficiencies they can wring out of it. Yay. The other side, though, is that the returns on utility projects are much less, and we're talking like half, than they would be in a traditional conventional oil project. Which way do you think, which one's going to win out?
To be honest, I think the oil companies are in for a disappointment, and all their aggressive targets are probably going to be scaled back a bit, because if you look at the returns they're getting, as you said, it's much less than their conventional oil and gas and refining business. But also, utilities also have lower cost of capital and have been deploying renewable capacity for much longer, so they have better economies of scale and better knowledge of that space. So I think the utilities have the competitive advantage, but the pie is, to be honest, big enough for both oil and utilities to coexist together and compete with each other.
All right, so give us a sense, Elchin, I know you've covered utilities for a long time. What percentage of their business today is, I'll just use a layman's term, renewables or new energy? How is that compared today to maybe where they want to be in 5 or 10 years?
For utilities, it's still relatively small. I mean, it varies a lot. For some, it's already 90% of their business is renewables. For others, it's about quarter, but it's growing and will grow very rapidly because a lot of utilities are shutting their coal and nuclear power plants in the next 5 years. So for utilities, that's going to be not 100, but close to 80% within the next 5 to 7 years, I think. For oil, is going to continue to be a marginal business, but a growing one.
Are there going to be, within the oil community, though, some that are better suited for this, that they can retain a large portion of their oil business and also diversify into alternative energies? I'm kind of thinking of Total versus, like, a BP, for example, that's truly going all in and eventually it really feels like will become a traditional utility in some ways.
I mean, to me, the guys that are talking the least and doing the most are Equinor, to be honest, because they are one of the
world. They did change their name, so I mean, you've got to give them some props for that one.
What was it before?
Statoil.
Oh, okay.
That's not so good if you want to become a different kind of company.
Right.
Yeah, but yeah, they have invested a lot in offshore wind. They were the first mover among the big oils, and they've just sold their stake in their U.S. project to BP for a hefty sum. So I think they are focusing mostly on offshore wind, and I think that's where the advantage is. And because of the offshore aspect of oil and gas drilling and offshore wind, I think there are some major synergies there. So I think Equinor is huge. Again, BP is the most aggressive when you look at the number of gigawatts that they're planning to add. Whether they're going to add it or not is another question, but yeah.
So,
and then you get like Total.
Yeah, are some countries doing a better job, or some regions of the world? I'm thinking, like, you know, I think here in the U.S. we're still shooting sand and water into the ground, whereas I'm hearing some other parts of the world are really much more ahead of others. Is there a regional aspect to it?
Absolutely. I mean, again, there's a big divide between U.S. utilities and European ones, and there's a similar divide between U.S. oil majors and the European ones. Again, the European companies are pretty much at the forefront of the green transition in their respective sectors, so and that divide may continue. Again, the only standout in the U.S. is probably NRG and AES, which are utilities that are investing heavily in renewables and battery storage. Whereas when it comes to Exxon's and Chevron's and whatnot, they're going to pretty much focus on just improving efficiency of their existing oil and gas business and maybe divest a few heavy oil assets that they have and that's about it, to be honest.
Yeah,
so,
totally.
Europe is pretty much at the forefront.
Particularly when it comes to Exxon. So I'm wondering if there's room for all of them. Like, is there room for the more utility players here in the U.S. diversifying into alternative energy and also the European majors that are going to diversify into alternative energy? Can they all play, or are there going to be specific winners and losers?
There are going to definitely be specific winners and losers. And again, when you look at the share prices of utilities versus oil companies, and even within oil companies, those who have invested heavily earlier in renewables have been more immune to COVID headwinds and whatnot. And for some of them, for European utilities like Enel and Iberdrola, their share price have eclipsed that of Eni and Total and whatnot. So the market is already discounting the oil, so the oil sector could be a loser here if they don't clean up the act quickly, which they may not do because the returns are lower in renewables. So it's a catch-22.
Well, I could talk about this for hours, but Paul's like, all right, let's move. We got to move next segment, Alex. Okay. Our thanks to Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Industry Analyst Elchin Mammadov.
Well, let's switch gears to pipelines. Costs, confrontation, and delays continue to trouble the industry. To help us walk us through it all, we welcome Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Litigation Analyst Brandon Barnes. And Brandon, give us a sense of when we think about oil pipelines, we're just talking oil and the volatility of the global oil markets, but talk to us about the pipelines and what's happening in terms of getting these things constructed, maintained, and developed.
Paul, thanks for having me. It's not just oil, it's also natural gas, but certainly oil is front of mind when it comes to pipelines. We think about Dakota Access, we think about Keystone XL. The issues that they've been running into since we were talking about Dakota Access back in 2016. It's high costs, related to court delays, activist movements on the ground, regulatory issues and permitting agencies. You know, these things are adding costs up to $170 million a quarter per that quarter of delay by our estimates.
Whoa, that's a lot. So let's pretend like it's November 4th or January 21st, depending on when we know things. Does the pipeline world get easier or does it get harder depending on who's in the White House and kind of what is state versus what is federal?
That's a great question, because I think everyone has a sense of where that's headed, right? We all believe maybe, okay, Trump just should be easier on pipelines, on infrastructure generally, but, you know, and Biden's got the environmental movement behind him, and that's part of his constituency. But really, what's happened under Trump's administration is the blowback from his election really surged, you know, membership drives by Sierra Club and those groups that are in the courts. They're doing the work. They need that money to go ahead and then use this shotgun approach to get in the courts and get into a number of different venues and sue. And so I think even if Trump is back in office, we still are in the same spot we're in right now where you can't build anything new anyway. So, you know, it's hard to imagine that getting worse under President Biden, but certainly there are ways that can be locked in for a longer term because you've got agency issues at FERC, which is the agency that, you know, does the siting for all the natural gas pipelines. That's got some big stuff coming up in 2021 that is up for debate and could change the way pipelines are approved for a long time.
So what are the companies doing, Brandon? It just sounds like a legal regulatory nightmare stacked up against them. How do they kind of, what's their strategy?
It depends on which company we're talking about. For some, you know, you've got Kinder Morgan does a really good job of managing community involvement and getting in front of the communities and trying to get those sort of that backing. But they're also doing it in relatively friendly venues. Maybe they're in Texas. Maybe they're in other areas like that where people are used to seeing pipelines run through. Whereas Energy Transfer has sort of been a poster child for difficulties, whether it's Mariner East or Dakota Access or Bayou Bridge. They've run into a buzzsaw where they seem to have tried to push through the issues instead of slowing things down.
Brandon, super awesome to talk to you. Bloomberg Intelligence Senior Litigation Analyst Brandon Barnes.
That's this week's edition of Bloomberg Intelligence on Bloomberg Radio, providing in-depth research and data on 2,000 companies and 130 industries.
And remember, you can access Bloomberg Intelligence through BI Go on the terminal. I'm Alex Steele.
And I'm Paul Sweeney. It's 57 minutes past the hour, and this is Bloomberg.